Hello and welcome to another episode of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe's podcast. I'm Simon Mundy, and today I'm talking to two of the orchestra's longer-serving members, the violinist from Sweden, Ulrika Jansson, and the bass trombonist, Nick Estop, who's from England. However, they're both now in Sweden, and they've been married for many years too, so this is one of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe's romantic successes. During the course of the interview, in which we cover all sorts of topics, such as the instruments themselves and the positions of the orchestra, there's also moments of music, and you'll hear Rossini's overture for La Cenerentola, conducted by Claudio Abbado, Dvorak's Slavonic Dance Opus 46 No. 5, conducted by Niklas Harnoncourt, and then you'll hear some Rossini again, a moment from his Viaggio a Reims, conducted by Claudio Abbado, with Lucia Valentina Tirani as the soprano and Francisco Arraiza as the tenor. And then at the end, we hear moments from Schubert's Missa Solemnis, his E-flat Mass, conducted by Niklas Harnoncourt with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, of course, and the Arnold Schoenberg Choir of Vienna. Here is Nick Estop and Ulrika Jansson. Nick and Ulrika, you've been in the orchestra for a very long time, and you come into it quite near the beginning of its history. Who actually came in first?
Oh, well, that would have been me. 1982 was my first ever trip with the orchestra, and we played the Rossini Stabat Mater in Pesaro in Italy. And it was a 9-day project with Jedda, an Italian conductor. It was wonderful. Very exciting to meet all my old friends from the European Youth Orchestra and to have a trip down to Italy. It was absolutely glorious, and I thought it would just be a one-off trip. In those days, none of us really expected it to develop into a lifetime's career.
I joined in 85. Hmm? At 81, when the orchestra was formed, Sweden was not in the EU. I joined because I heard about the orchestra from Charlotte Geselbracht, a violist, German violist, who I played quartet with in Freiburg, where I studied at the time. And she was reading about the orchestra and said they needed violinists. And a few months later, I arrived to Paris for some reason. And I went to a concert and was, of course, blown away by the orchestra and decided to make an audition.
Ulrika, how was it playing with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe for the first time?
It was absolutely sensational. I enjoyed it so much. I remember the first time we played the Rossini overtures with Claudio Abbado, and it was like floating on top of a glass of champagne. You were just bubbling away, and I remember just laughing loud because it was unbelievable. And then the orchestra had played it on tours before me, so to say, I didn't expect this feeling. That was sensational and fantastic. So, unforgettable.
Several players have told me that they came to a concert, were taken to a concert, and then thought, having heard the orchestra, that they wanted to play in it. And I wonder how many times that happens. Do you often go to an orchestra and think, ooh, that's good? Or do you sometimes go to an orchestra and think, oh, well, I'll do this gig, but I'm not bothered if I get asked back or not?
No, that never happens, because I always think that's nowhere near as good as CLE. I only want to play with one orchestra. Oh, that's a joke, by the way.
As a bass trombonist, I'm sure it is a joke, because it's not the instrument that gets called on most often for a chamber orchestra in the classical style.
No, that's true. I'm only required for about a third of the orchestra's work, I would say. And in the early days, it was even less than that, because it was a lot more small chamber productions. It was when Claudio and then Harman Kaur started doing the Schumann symphonies and the Brahms symphonies, which called for larger forces, then suddenly I was needed a lot more.
Do you double on the other trombones, or is it just the bass for you?
Very rarely. I try and avoid it because I find it quite scary having to go up into the ultra-high registers. I have actually played tenor trombone twice with the orchestra. Once was a Ravel piano concerto. I was on tour to play another piece in the programme, and because of the change of soloist, the concerto changed, and I was asked if I would then play the Ravel piano concerto, which I regret doing because it was absolutely terrifying. I had a quick look at the part and really underestimated the challenges involved. It was a scary experience. The other time was Beethoven's Sixth, which only has two trombones. For some reason, I was asked to do that trick as well, but rarely.
The thing about the bass trombone is that, unlike other bass instruments, it's quite exposed. I always think, as a bass singer myself, and double bassists have told me that they can rumble around at the bottom and nobody really bothers about them too much. But as a bass trombone, you're quite loud, so people notice you.
Yes, well, you have that sort of double role in the orchestra. Composers tend to use it quite sparingly as an effect, often in the loud passages. But the real joy of playing with the chamber orchestra of Europe is all the quiet passages, the creepy chorale bits in Brahms and Schumann. And you really have to mingle with the orchestra, and getting that the voicing is right, and it's incredibly exciting. So I have to say, the loud bits are such a joy. You know, when you're playing with such an amazing orchestra, to be the front of the bass, the front of the foundation for the whole orchestra, it's incredibly exciting and a most wonderful feeling.
When you're listening, to judging that ability to decide how loud you're going to play and how you're going to meld in with the sound, which of the other instruments do you take your cue from? I mean, is there a particular section you think, yes, now there's where I want to match?
When we're talking about the upper levels of, you know, loudness, it's like timpani, trumpets, they're the instruments I can hear most clearly. Because when we're really going for it, it's like, you know, those crazy photos of Harman Kaur when you look like his head is about to explode and he wants us to just give everything we've got. To give a feeling of giving everything you got without blowing the orchestra off the stage, I'm playing at such a level that I can't really hear many other people. So the visual contact becomes very important. So I often I'm paying a lot of attention to the leader, obviously the conductor, and then try and listen to the rest of my colleagues in the brass and percussion.
And Ulrike, I mean, in the violin section, are you sometimes aware of Nick blasting from the other side of the stage, or do you try and avoid the noise?
Of course I'm aware about the noise.
Noise?
No, but it's lovely. I really appreciate when me being at the other end or playing high up somewhere and then feel the sound that we can float on or high.
Actually, when Ulrika's on tour, it's great to have that familiar face. They're all familiar faces, but have that particular face in the orchestra sitting opposite. I mean, it's lovely. We communicate. There's a lot of sort of pulling faces and things across the orchestra.
Well, I know when you had a really difficult bit, and I can glance.
You can see me go pale and start sweating.
You know, enjoying when it went really well, and I can see you sort of.
Yeah.
When did you get together? I mean, how long had you both been playing in the orchestra when you got together as a partnership?
Well,
so to speak?
It was actually very early we got together, funny enough.
Yeah, it was in 1985. Ulrika was in London to do her first trial with the orchestra, which I was unaware of. But we met at the concert. My brother was playing the Britten tenor horn and strings with the London Symphony in the Queen Elizabeth Hall, and I went to listen. And Ulrika went to listen with some people who also knew my brother. So we met in the pub. I was sitting there with my brother, and this group came in with Ulrika. My eyes literally popped out of my head. I couldn't believe it. And she sat next to me, and we got talking, and I think most of the evening was me trying to learn how to say her name. I'd never met anyone called Peruka before, so I sort of got the hang of it. And I was bowled off my feet, literally, and sort of decided, well, this might not be the one, but it could be, and I'm going to do everything I possibly can to make this happen.
And at what stage did you say, can I come and live in Sweden, please?
About half an hour later, I think. No,
it took 5 years.
Yeah,
5 years.
Sort of regularly over the following 5 years.
Yeah, we married June 1990.
Yeah.
And we moved to Sweden.
Yeah.
And we lived.
Yeah, I mean, those 5 years were amazing. It was a very exciting and romantic time. But the early stages included lots of fun things like a motorcycle camping holiday in Italy and motorcycling around Paris and Rome. And
Nick turned up with his motorbike. I think we had a project in Paris with only strings or a small orchestra, and suddenly Nick turned up.
Yeah, I turned up and I rode down from London just for in the off time.
Yeah, so.
And the management saying, if you expect your expenses, forget them. We don't need a bass trombone for this one. And, I mean, Ulrika, you're now leading the Swedish Radio Symphony Orchestra. Nick, do you sometimes play with them as well?
I have a regular job with the Uppsala Chamber Orchestra, but just do odd freelance gigs in Stockholm. Not regularly, because I'm mostly busy at the Museum of Performing Arts, where I'm curator of the instrument collection. So I don't have a lot of time for other gigs, but I mean, it happens.
Well, that, of course, leads to the next question. How many instruments in the museum can you play?
Of the ones that are playable, it depends what you say play. Get a sound out of an instrument?
Getting a tolerable sound out of the instrument.
Yeah, hundreds. But to be able to play a tune, about five, I would say.
Ulrika, do you only play the modern violin, or do you play the Baroque violin as well?
I have tried playing the Baroque violin. I can say I played on gut strings. We had a Baroque orchestra for a while here in Stockholm, but not seriously. I can't call myself a Baroque player. I have a violin with gut strings playing around. I think we learned so much from Harnoncourt, how to play in a Baroque style. I mean, that was really the big thing about the Beethoven recordings we did, that we learned how to play in a gut string way on modern instruments. And but certainly there is a fantastic experience to try to play on gut strings. You really understand then fully how different you have to play, basically, also with a Baroque bow. You can't, you just have to play differently.
The other thing about the COE, which is like an early music group, but is not like a modern symphony orchestra, is that you move around, don't you? You don't have a set place in the section.
Yes, that's lovely. That's one of the most lovely things, I must say, with a violin section in COE. We take turns. Every other tour we play first, every other tour we play second, and you sit at the front, at the back, with all your colleagues differently every tour. That is absolutely wonderful. So it's not, you understand what it's like to sit at the back and at the front, which means that the section really benefit from that.
What's the difference? I mean, how does it actually feel when you're playing in those different positions? Is there one particular position where you feel very much more part of it than the others?
Well, of course, if you sit a bit more in the middle, it's much easier to hear the rest of the group, hear the orchestra. If you sit at this place we call Suicide Corner, which is when you sit at the back of the first outside, your violin is facing the audience, so the sound goes out to the hall and doesn't mix with a group, you can say, and it's just harder to see. You are very much at the side. You see the conductor sideways, and it's difficult to have the courage to play fully because you tend to hear a lot of yourself more than the group.
This is why I suppose so many conductors like to have their best players at the back of the section, because they know they need to have that confidence.
Yes. Yes, it's a good point. Actually, quite many conductors say now that, please, can I have more sound from the back, which is very encouraging for the group, and it's very good. And if you sit at the front, it's also wonderful to hear the group from the back. But it's a question of hearing and having confidence to play. It's not only to play loud. I mean, you must know where to play. But it's very good that we mix, and also because we have played during the years a lot of classical repertoire, which of course suits the size of the orchestra. It's such a difference to play first and second.
And quite a lot of conductors like to have an antiphonal sound with firsts on the left and seconds on the right. Does that make a huge difference for you as a player?
This is a difficult issue, I find. Sometimes it is wonderful, but it is also very hard sometimes. And depends on the whole. In my orchestra here in Stockholm, we have now, since quite many years, having this opposite seating, and in our hall it's very hard to hear. And with a big symphony orchestra, the distance is huge. This whole stage is between the back of the first and the back of the second. So we are actually trying to sometimes play the old-fashioned way or the new modern way, whichever you think it is. And I think for the first violins, it's lovely to have the seconds next to you in more romantic repertoire, because we very often have play in octaves, and if you can hear the seconds, you play easier in tune, and the sound of the violins mix together. So I sometimes long a bit going back there, but I think for COE, with that repertoire, it's perfect with this opposite seating most of the time.
The other question is, of course, if you're playing seconds and you're playing on the right-hand side of the stage, your violin sound is going back towards the rest of the orchestra, not to the audience. Does this make a big difference to how you play?
In some ways, it makes it easier. You can go more risky because the sound is muted, you can say, or it doesn't sound so direct for the audience. And when you sit on the outside of the first, you feel sometimes incredibly, or you feel you are sometimes incredibly close to the audience, maybe just a couple of meters, and that makes it very delicate, the way the sound you make. And if you just sit in the seconds, you're more protected, if you understand what I mean.
With the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, which conductors have favoured which? Which ones want them antiphonally either side of them, and which ones want the violins together?
I think most of the time now we play opposite. I can't remember when we didn't.
No, it's sort of become the default.
It's become the orchestra's shape. I can't really think of any.
Do you remember when we started? I think Claudio
experimented. Yeah, Claudio, then we certainly had the old, the per second next to each other. Maybe it got into fashion, but it was, as I remember, it was Harmon Korth that really settled that. And he sort of made it modern everywhere. Before that, I had never played something like that.
And do you think most young conductors now favour that way?
It seems like that, yes. It depends, of course, on their repertoire. I don't know if that's true. I heard that it, around 1920 they changed it because of recording issues with stereo effects and like that. And it sounded better to have the upper voices to the left and the bass to the right. And before that it was on both, opposite. And so we had a conductor, Manfred Honeck, with us for a few years, and he had that policy that if we played repertoire before 1920, we were sitting next to each other while in section.
Nick, let's talk about your instrument too. I mean, the bass trombone. Has it changed over the centuries? Are you now playing with something with lots of differences from how it would have been in 1820?
Yes, I think the instrument has changed dramatically. Perhaps the most obvious is that the actual basic instrument is smaller. in length only. The original bass trombones were pitched lower than the tenor. You had a whole family of trombones, a soprano, alto, tenor and bass, and they all had different pitches, and the bass trombone was often in low F4 E-flat. Then the valve was invented in the early 1800s, and trombonists discovered that it was the instrument became a bit easier to play if you had a higher pitched instrument with a valve to reach the lower notes. So what was the bass trombone actually became virtually the same instrument as a tenor trombone with a valve and a wider bore to give it a darker sound and to make the lower register a more impactful. And modern bass trombones have become even more extreme in that way. The bore has become wider and wider, and a few extra valves have been added. So if you see a trombone with lots of extra piping up over the shoulder with a really, really big bell, well, that's a modern bass trombone. And that was the sort of instrument I was using in the early days of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. The recordings of Jaja Rems and the Schubert symphonies with the Bardo, I had this huge, great, big, fat, modern bass trombone, which I sort of think now was probably a bit inappropriate for a Chamber Orchestra, but I didn't realise at the time. It was when Harnoncourt came along, and he came from the background, as Aruka said, he playing a lot of Baroque music and reaching for authenticity, and I have a feeling that he wanted to experiment with the authentic way of playing, so that it wasn't the instruments that were so important. He wanted to test how his theories of authentic interpretation worked with an orchestra that had modern instruments. But there was this area of the orchestra where the modern instruments had developed to such a degree that he felt that it really was just such a challenge to make it work and with his ideas. And that was the trombones, the trumpets and the timpani. Modern trombones and timpani have all become so big, and the trumpets have become more more conical. It's a different character of sound than the old natural trumpets. So he asked very politely if he wouldn't mind trying different instruments. After the first time he came, we had our modern instruments, and he noticed that this was going to be a problem in the future, so he asked us to change, and it was actually quite a dramatic change in many ways for me. It made playing in a small orchestra a very different experience.
Which one do you play now?
I swap. It depends on the repertoire, as so many other things.
He has about 30 different trombones.
Yes.
Can you tell the difference, Ulrika, when he plays his 30 different trombones? Is it like a tennis player trying to tell the difference between different tennis balls?
Well, maybe I could hear the difference from the biggest and the smallest.
I hope so. Yeah. Well, we actually had a bit of a shock. We moved a few years ago, and when I started packing up, I discovered a lot more trombones in the cupboards here and there than even I thought I had. But I basically have two that I choose between with the CLE. One is a sort of not the biggest modern instrument you can get, but a fairly large modern instrument for modern repertoire and for when a sort of soft, rounded sound is more appropriate. It's the smaller trombone that Harnoncourt preferred, which was actually a modern instrument, but just smaller. It's a lot more punchy, and you can play at a sort of what feels like a louder level. You can play the fortissimos and all the accents and everything as is written, but it doesn't dominate the orchestra as much. You get a sort of punchy, exciting sound, but without the breadth that would just swamp a small orchestra off
and
the
cover,
stage.
Cover too much.
Yeah, it would cover much too much, yeah.
And Ulrika, I mean, violinists, on the other hand, tend to sort of fall in love with their instruments and only play one. Is there a particular one that you play on all the time?
Yes, yes.
Is it an early one or is it a modern copy?
It is actually an old instrument from Naples, Josef Galliano, that I absolutely love. I have quite a history of instruments. I had a French violin, you see, that was stolen in Copenhagen on a CUE tour. It was found 7 years later, but then I had it in an auction in London. It's very exciting, actually, the story, but it was terrible for me. But at the end, it was okay. I found an Italian violin instead, which I actually had in Grimming.
And what date is that one?
I can't say exactly, actually, because it says another name. It says Alessandro Galliano in it, but around 1760.
I just wanted to ask about you've been playing with the orchestra so long. Can you notice a difference in atmosphere between the orchestra and its first 20 years and, say, the orchestra and this century?
Yes, I think the biggest change is that in the first years we were all the same age, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
I mean, we were all the same generation, and we were all wild and young. It was crazy. And nowadays, sort of the family members are all old and have children, grandchildren, and all the younger generation. I don't know if they don't seem to be as wild and crazy. Maybe they go off and be wild and crazy on their own without us.
Well, we've gone to like a normal orchestra, which is a mixture of age groups. And in the beginning, it was, of course, we were a youth orchestra in many ways. We were called a youth orchestra for 20 years.
We really were, which
was fantastic. I mean, we had such fun. It was amazing life on tour. And I just remember it as a long row of tour after tour. One was better than the other. And we just had such fun. And we were traveling and marvelous concerts, lovely.
It's still wonderful, and we look forward to the tours.
Yeah.
But you know, it's normal for us in a way now. We've been doing it for 40 years.
And now when we come back and meet our friends that we have known for 40 years, I mean that's unbelievable that we still see each other and enjoy seeing each other
and making lots of new friends as well.
Yes,
I mean, the new generation are wonderful. They're all fantastic. Yeah. And it's
amazing.
Players. Yeah.
But of course it's different. We are different.
Just tell me, whose musicianship has impacted on you over the years?
I must mention someone who actually meant the most for me. That was our leader, Marika Blankenstein. She meant so much for the orchestra and the level, the quality of playing, the stylishness of the orchestra, that she put such an impact on the way she played to all of us, I think, maybe particularly us string players, but I must mention her because she really took such a big role. I know what it's like to be a leader. It's difficult, it's tough, and you also have to deal with many human issues. I mean, just the contact with the conductor, the soloists, and just keeping the orchestra together. It's a tremendous job. And,
you feel like the captain of the team, I suppose.
Yes, but also her quality as an amazing violin player was so important for all of us. Also, I have to mention that now coming back, I'm meeting Lorenza Burani, who's just continuing this task in such a fantastic way, developing the orchestra. It is very important. I'm really appreciate leaders. They have a tremendous impact. I mean, I can't even think of all of them. Well, the singers. I mean,
the singers,
recorded the Mozart operas.
I remember one particular singer, this is really going back to ancient history, the first few summers we did the Rossini Opera Festival in Italy and recorded, amongst other things, Viaggio a Reims with Claudio. And there was a contralto, Lucia Valentini Terrani, who was the most, she was a larger than life character, she was an incredible personality and a true virtuoso. And such a powerful voice, it was incredible. She blew the whole orchestra away, and we all fell in love with her. And there were constant parties, and she would literally be hair raising. She'd come in onto the platform knowing the orchestra loved her and loved every second, and she would be inspired by that and reach greater and greater heights. And it was just extraordinary, the energy. It's unforgettable.
Nick, I was just wondering, I mean, the different styles of conductors, you know, Harnoncourt and Claudio Abbado no longer with us, and Bernard Haitink now retired. Who are the conductors that you see coming through that you're playing with where you think, yes, this is where the next generation of great conductor is coming from?
Well, there's one very clear name that leaps to mind, and that's Yannick Nezet-Séguin, who has been performing with us for a number of years now, and we've developed a very powerful and deep relationship. I mean, it's easy to develop a relationship with him. He's such a lovable, wonderful, likeable person. But he has this incredible musicianship and a fantastic energy. There's something about him, actually, that reminds me of the early days with Claudio. Claudio was so elegant and beautiful. I've never seen such a beautiful conducting technique. To watch him was just an utter joy. But he could also whip the orchestra into a frenzy in an unexpected and wonderful way. And Yannick has that as well. Yannick has an energy that he can pump into the orchestra. I was trying to think what we were doing recently. It was probably a Schumann symphony. And we get into the finale and it starts racing towards the end. And I was a 20-year-old back meeting Claudio for the first time. The years disappeared and there was just this incredible energy. It was wonderful. So Yannick clearly, I think. And I think we could say CRE has been through clear periods of associations with certain conductors, Claudio, Harnoncourt, Bernard, and I think these years will become a probably on them already as the Yannick years, and I just hope it's going to last for a long time. There's something special with our relationship with it.
And something I have to ask a bass trombonist, because you sit there at the back of the orchestra with one sheet of paper on the music stand, and I always wonder whether you do actually have to sit there counting 134, 135, 136. 435, 437, 438, and how on earth you managed to do that?
You do have to count the bars, but in your first rehearsal, there's no alternative. You have to count them. And we often are counting the same number of bars in the section, the trombone section, so we help each other. We have hand signals that we can show. And when big numbers that are marked in the part go past, we make it a signal to help each other. But in pieces like, as I mentioned earlier, the Schumann symphonies, we've done them a number of times. And now I just sit and enjoy the music and just know when to play. And that's a lovely feeling of freedom. You hardly have to look in the part at all, to be honest. And it really, then we're back to the idea of chamber music, that you're just sitting there playing, reacting 100% to the orchestra and conductor, and it's all just one amazing body of sound and energy. Fantastic.
And you never have the conductor saying, yeah, Mr. Eastop, we're here today, where are you?
Oh yes, that happens, I'm afraid. Particularly, as you may or may not know, I take lots of photographs during rehearsals. And actually, if you look on the orchestra's Facebook page, there's a photo there that I took as Bernard Haitink stopped the orchestra because I'd forgotten to play. And now I was sitting with my camera. So the picture is of the entire orchestra looking at me thinking, why aren't you playing? So, yeah, accidents happen.
That's great. Thank you both very much indeed. You've been listening to me, Simon Mundy, in conversation with Nick Eastop, the bass trombonist, and Ulrika Janssen, his wife, the violinist, two of the longer-serving members of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. In the course of it, you also heard some music, Rossini's Overture to La Cenerentola and a snippet from Il Viaggio a Reims, both conducted by Claudio Bardo on Deutsche Grammophon. And Viaggio a Reims was 1985 Recording of the Year for Gramophone magazine. And then you heard Nicholas Harnoncourt conducting Dvořák's Slavonic Dance Opus 46 No. 5 and part of Schubert's E-flat Major Mass, both on Teldec from Warner Classics. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe's podcast, and I look forward to welcoming you again to our next one.